Good morning. If we could turn to Daniel chapter 11. First, I want to apologize. Yesterday we went through a lot of prophetic symbology. And it was, the intent was for just a, simply an overview to provide the foundations for the things that we're seeing in the world today. But all of those symbols and all of the binds that tie all that together deserve a lot more careful and methodical consideration than our whirlwind overview or our 30,000 feet overfly of those that subject matter. So I hate to rush through it the way that we did, but it was the only way that we could think of in order to supply at least some kind of at least mention before going into the things of the world that we see today. But let's start in Daniel chapter 11, starting at the 40th verse. We read, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious at holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him." The passage does not stop there. It does not stop there. It continues. Chapter 12. "And at that time," and at that time, what time are we talking about? Verse 40, at the time of the end. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." This passage, starting in that 40th verse of Daniel 11, has not yet been fulfilled. Again, we have to see prophecy, and we have to see current events through the right and correct lens of a correct view of prophecy. Associated with the time surrounding Christ's return to the earth, the prophet Daniel in the 12th chapter reveals a tremendous time of trouble and distress for both Israel and the nations of the earth. Christ, symbolized by Michael, or who is like ale, is prophesied to stand up or present himself on behalf of the Israelite people, who will have been previously invaded and critically oppressed by the king of the north. In other words, Russia and its confederacy, as described previously in the latter portion of Daniel 11. The Spirit, through Daniel, describes this grand crisis as a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. For Israel and the Jews worldwide, for Israel and for the Jews worldwide, it is more descriptively described as the time of Jacob's trouble, which is found in Jeremiah 30 and 7. But it provides, Jeremiah provides this added information of hope, that he shall be saved out of it. He shall be saved out of it. When Christ and the newly immortalized saints are revealed on the world stage, when they hit the Gogian Confederacy firmly entrenched in Israel, of course there's a lot more process than that. They're saving the tents of Judah first. It's initial attack at Basra, and of course the rescue of Jerusalem. But by the time we get to this point, the world will already have been in a state of unparalleled upheaval. Unparalleled upheaval. The world will be divided into two primary alliances. Now, if we think about World War I, World War II, there was the Axis powers and there were the Allied powers. We're going to see something very similar and close to some of the same lines that we have seen in the past. But the world will be divided into two primary alliances, and the Gentile powers will be mired in a struggle of fleshly ambition as well as survival. Daniel, in chapter 11, describes these spheres of influence as the king of the north and the king of the south. These were the most powerful divisions of the divided Grecian empire that struggled for control over the lands of the eastern Mediterranean during the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, before and concurrent with the rise of the Roman Empire. Caught in the middle of this struggle was the Israelite Commonwealth, that was at the mercy of these competing powers until the rise of the Roman power, or as described in Daniel 8 that we very quickly brushed over, the little horn of the goat and his exaltation to power. Verse 40 of Daniel 11 picks up again to talk about the time of the end and a resurgence of this historical conflict concurrent with the return of Christ, with a restored Israelite state clearly indicated here, as well as we know in Ezekiel 38 and other connected prophecies. We think of Zechariah 14 as well, off the top of our head. The spirit of prophecy draws upon this ancient north-south struggle to describe the divisions of power to be manifested in the end times, with Israel once again in the crosshairs, with Israel once again in the crosshairs of a geopolitical struggle. So there we have our map of the ancient king of the north and then the king of the south, or Ptolemaic kingdom. Seleucid kingdom to the north, the Ptolemaic kingdom to the south. This is to be revived. Different nations, different powers involved, but nonetheless to be revived. Zechariah prophetically described this division as two mountains of brass in chapter 6, verse 1. In Zechariah chapter 6, verse 1. Let's take a look at that for just a moment. What does this have to do with what we are seeing and what we hope to see? It has everything to do with it. Zechariah chapter 6, 1, if I can get there. And I turned and I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, there came four chariots out from between two mountains. And the mountains were mountains of brass. Again, Zechariah prophetically describes this north-south division as two mountains of brass. And of course, brass connects with the Grecian influence. It is through these two mountains, or two powers, north and south, that the symbolic power of the cherubim, in other words, Christ and the saints, goes forth to conquer at the time of the end. Again, we have two main powers set up, two alliances, we can say, an axis and an allied two divisions involved, and it is Christ and the saints that intermeddle with this in the last time. The prophet Ezekiel, as we have already mentioned several times, describes it as a Gogian-led confederacy of nations in chapter 38, verses 2, 5, and 6, with the other opposing side as a Tarshish alliance, British or English-speaking in nature. That is, it's an allied league of what is said, is referenced as young lions. And of course, the young lions are the formerly British surrogate nations. And this is, and I believe this is from, I think this is from World War I, this poster. Many of you have probably seen this before, but the empire needs men, the call to bring in the rest of the British Empire to help out. Australia, Canada, India, New Zealand, all answer the call. Helped by the young lions, the old lion defies his foes. Enlist now. So the symbology of Tarshish and the young lions, that's a whole other consideration, but it is and points directly to a British alliance. This latter-day alliance is to also include, according to Ezekiel 38, the Gulf State nations, Sheba and Dedan. Let's look at that. Instead of me just referencing it, let's look at it. Ezekiel 38. Let's look at the Gogian Confederacy first, chapter 38, verse 1. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. And say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. These are indicators of the Russian territory, which we'll have a map to show in just a moment. And I will turn thee back and put hooks in thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. And on the other side is this Tarshish nation. Start at the 10th verse. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, still speaking of this Gogian confederacy, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, their grand move against the land of Israel. To take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, the Jews that have been restored, the partial restoration, which have gotten cattle and goods that dwell in the midst of the land. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto them, Art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey? To carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? No matter how chaotic the scene appears before us at the present time, the world has not yet arrived to the state of circumstances described by the prophets. But we are seeing the picture come together brilliantly. Now all these things, this subject matter converges. At the very top we have a picture of what is described in Revelation 16 of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, in other words, Russia, Europe, and the papacy. And these three elements that spout out frog-like spirits or spirits of humanistic thought will converge upon this issue of Israel. And that's why we have Israel in the center. And we want to be understood that you cannot, of course, take your eyes off of Israel. Israel is the primary element of everything that we are talking about here. Now, as outliers, and we don't mean that they're insignificant, but they are, prophetically speaking, are outlier issues. We, of course, have the U.S.-British Tarsus Alliance, and we'll talk a little bit about how the U.S. fits into all this. The Arab Islamic nations who are friendly or tolerant of Israel, and that is quite a remarkable latter-day coming together that we have seen. But there are also Arab or Islamic nations not tolerant of Israel as well that come into play in all of this. We start with Russia, the dragon. As it is clearly what is driving geopolitical events. Now, Russia has been dismissed for quite some time, especially in the United States, by the United States government. It has been dismissed as really a kind of a secondary issue. The China, it's all about China. Well, no, prophetically speaking, it's not about China. Why has Russia seemingly risked everything for the Ukraine? Things are not going well for Russia right now. Why have they risked everything for the Ukraine? There are a great deal of complications that are involved with Russia's move, as well as far-reaching consequences as we have seen in a geopolitical domino effect put into motion. Russia has not had an easy time, but as the conflict grinds on, Ukraine's defeat appears more certain. It is clear that Putin sees the effort as worthwhile. Now, within the past 2 weeks, Putin gave a hint to his motivations. In an address to Russian entrepreneurs about a week and a half ago, which was the 350th anniversary of Peter the Great's birth, very famous emperor or king of the Russian Empire, Peter the Great, Putin gave homage to Peter the Great. He has a lot of respect for Peter the Great. Yeah. Of course, we'll come back to this Latter-day map here, but let's jump ahead to this. Putin is from St. Petersburg, which of course obviously bears the former Tsar's name. From the Washington Post article, and this is where this is from, but there was many different sources for this, but our source is the Washington Post. Putin had this to say. He says, "What was Peter doing?" Putin asked Thursday, according to the Associated Press. Putin went on to say, "Taking back and reinforcing. That's what he did. And it looks like it fell on us to take back and reinforce as well." Now, these comments were widely seen as a reference to Putin's attack on Ukraine, which he has long viewed as part of Russia's sphere of influence. Now, Putin was talking about the 20-year war that Peter undertook with the Swedish Empire that eventually resulted in Russia taking control of many of the Baltic states. In the past, Putin has stated that he is about reliving the Russian imperial dream, and that the man who made Russia, referencing again Peter, the man who made Russia into an imperial empire was Peter the Great. In a 2019 interview with Britain's Financial Times, Putin stated that the Tsar will live as long as he is alive. Meaning, as long as Putin is alive, the Tsar will live. Now, the Russians and many of the people of the Middle East and of Europe, they know their history. We don't know their history like we should. Believers have a better handle on it. But these people know their history. And of course, there's the will of Peter the Great. There is some questions as to the validity or the authenticity of this will. Whether it is or not, Brother Thomas, of course, quotes this in his, I believe it's the Herald magazine. I can't remember off the top of my head what year that's quoted. But the will of the Peter the Great is quite interesting, and something that we see, especially Putin, is following along pretty well with. We're not going to list all the points of this, but on point number one of Peter the Great's will, he says to keep the Russian nation, this is his advice for future Russians, to keep the Russian nation in constant warfare in order to always have good soldiers. That's kind of a problem with Russia right now, is that they haven't been a very active, not to the extent that the United States has been. So their military's had a tough time of getting going again. So this has really been, with this war with Ukraine, is really a good effort to get their swords sharpened once again. He says, peace must only be permitted to remit the finances, to recruit the army, choose the moment favorable for attack. Thus peace will advance your projects of war and war with those of peace for obtaining the enlargement and prosperity of Russia. And point number nine, he says, do all in your power and approach closely Constantinople and India. Remember that he who rules over these countries is the real sovereign of the world. He who rules over Constantinople and India. Keep up continued wars with Turkey and with Persia, modern day, as we know, Iran. Establish dockyards in the Black Sea. Gradually obtain the command of the sea as well as of the Baltic. And I think the Baltic is going to be a move not too far in the future. This is necessary for the entire success of our projects. Hasten the fall of Persia. Open for yourselves a route towards the Persian Gulf. Reestablish as much as possible by means of Syria, the ancient commerce of the Levant, and thus advance towards India. Once there, you will not require English gold. Some of that we see, some of that not necessarily. It goes on, constantly extend yourselves along the shores of the Baltic and the borders of the Euxine or the Black Sea. Of course, he's trying to do all that he can right now to secure the Black Sea. Do all in your power to... Wait a second, There we go, that's where I wanted to go to. Sorry about that. And then point 13, Sweden dismembered, Persia conquered, Poland subjugated, and Poland is shaking in their boots right now. Turkey beaten, our armies united, the Black and Baltic seas guarded by our vessels. Prepare separately and secretly, first the court of Versailles, or France, then that of Vienna, to share the empire of the universe with Russia. If one accept, flatter her ambition, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that, and make use of one to crush the other by engaging them in war. The result cannot be doubtful. Russia will be possessed of the whole of the East and of a great portion of Europe. And point 14, if which is not probable, both should refuse the offer of Russia, raise a quarrel between them, meaning cause conflict among those European nations, divide and conquer, we might say, and one which will ruin them both. Then Russia, profiting by this decisive moment, will inundate Germany with the troops which she will have assembled beforehand. At the same time, two fleets full of soldiers will have the Baltic and the Black Sea, will advance along the Mediterranean and the ocean, keeping France in check with one and Germany with the other. And these two countries conquered, the remainder of the Europe will fall under our yoke. Thus can Europe be subjugated. We see Putin working on that as we speak. France and Germany still are the two primary players on the European continent. And both of them are playing a very dangerous game with Russia as we speak. Now, again, as we stated, Putin knows his history. Let's back up to this map that I wanted to put up there. Putin knows his history. Many cultures, societies outside of the Western culture know their history, and they also hold grudges. Case in point is the grudge that the Russians still hold of being ejected out of Constantinople by the Ottomans. Of course, they weren't Russians at that time, but as far as their religious and political roots, they very much hold to Constantinople, or what we know as Istanbul today. This great disadvantage to those of the West is that they think they can diplomatically get their way by whitewashing over differences and long-held grudges. That's the problems we see in American foreign policy. They think with a little bit of money, with a little bit of sweet talk, that they can smooth things over. Therefore, we see Western diplomats, especially of the United States, fail miserably in their dealings with those like the Russians or countries of the Middle East. They think that sanctions are going to dissuade Russia. We are seeing the exact opposite. But this is not how these people think. Putin sees himself and his country as something of destiny. It's a nation of destiny in Putin's eyes and his people's eyes, to fulfill glories of the past and to conquer all enemies. The world is a chessboard for Putin, where he and those that think like him figure out their moves many steps in advance. So why the Ukraine? Why the Ukraine? Well, the territory of Ukraine holds a great deal of Russia's roots. If we go back to Genesis chapter 10, and you can turn it up, I'm not going to necessarily make exact references, but Genesis 10, under the sons of Japheth, we see many of the names mentioned that are listed in Ezekiel 38 as coming against Israel in the end times. Gomer, Magog, Madai, which actually ended up being the Persians, Madai, M-A-D-A-I, as well as Tubal and Meshech. Javan is not mentioned, but his son was Tarshish, which actually will be an opposition to the Gogian host. And we are seeing that play out even as we speak. The Ukraine has become a proxy war between the U.S. and Britain. And Tarshish, which is Tarshish, between that and Russia. Now, up there we also have the name of Tyrus. What about Japheth's son, Tyrus? Josephus records that Tyrus settled in the area of Constantinople, and from him came the Thracians. Tyrus, the son of Japheth, settled in the area of Constantinople, and from him came the Thracians. These people were known as fierce warriors and pirates, and eventually settled northward on the Tyrus River near what we know as Tarsifol, or the city of Tyrus. This is actually located in Moldova, which is not far from Odessa, Ukraine. I think I have another map for that as well. Yeah, that's not very good. We'll leave it there. It is interesting to note that Moldova is considered to be one of the next nations to fall to Russia. Russia has already been making very strong telegraphs that Moldova, you're next. And of course, the Moldovans really identify themselves as Russians anyway. There is also historical connection between these people and what ended up being the Vikings, interestingly enough. But it is from this region that the Russian Empire would be born. Gibbon, in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the 7th volume, page 18, if you have that on your bookshelf, stated that among the Greeks, the national appellation for the Russians had a singular name of Ros, R-O-S. This is traced to Japheth's youngest son, Tyrus, or the last three letters of Tyrus, T-Y-R-U-S, of Rus, or Rus, Tyrus, Rus, or Russians, or as we used to say, or used to call them, the Ruskies, or Ruskies. It was in the 9th century A.D. that the Viking prince Oleg of Novgorod founded the state of Kievan Rus. Kievan Rus, which, again, modern-day Ukraine falls squarely in this. Now, this map that we have actually comes out, we stole it out of the milestones, the latest milestones overview from this past March, which provides a very good history of this connection of Ukraine being very much a part of the Russian destiny, and it's because it's so entrenched in their history. Oleg was succeeded by Grand Prince Igor, whom Soviet historians look upon as the true beginning of the Russian princely line. Dukes, his widow Olga succeeded him and the state flourished. She maintained a strong link to Constantinople and was converted to Christianity. Olga's son remained a pagan, but it was through the baptism of his own son, Vladimir, in around 988 AD, that the Orthodox Church came to be the state religion of this region. The Orthodox Church, which was centered in Constantinople. Vladimir had sent envoys to study the religions of the surrounding nations, and they had been most impressed by the Orthodox Church in Constantinople. He agreed to be baptized in return for having the Byzantine emperor's sister in marriage. His baptism took place in Crimea, and returning home had his subjects baptized in the Dnieper, I think is how it's pronounced, river that runs through Kiev. He vigorously swept away the pagan temples and started building churches throughout the Kievan Rus Empire. By the mid-11th century, Kievan Rus was the biggest and strongest state in Europe, according to the Soviet historian Grekov. The Orthodox Church played an important role in its development. Under pressure from the Mongols under Genghis Khan, the state of Kievan Rus was broken up, its rulers and priests barbarously tortured, and Kiev was sacked in 1240 AD. Kiev's Russian inhabitants were forced northwards. I guess some people say Kiev. I've always understood it as Kiev. And Moscow began to grow in importance. Our first reference to Moscow occurs in 1137 AD, and by the 14th century it became the center of the Russian nation. With the fall of Constantinople in 1453, the center of Orthodox Christianity now flourished, not in Constantinople, but flourished in Russia under Ivan III. In 1462, Moscow had become the political as well as the religious center of the Russian lands. It was a period in which the basic territory of Russia was welded into a single state and completely liberated from the Tatar yoke, in which the political foundations of that state took shape. So Ukraine, at least in the Russians' mind, is Russia. It is their birthplace. It is the birthplace of the Russian nation. We only wish to provide this history to show that Russia views this territory as their own. Ukraine, Moldova, and the Baltic states to the north. Russia isn't done. And whether it is Putin or a successor, they will keep going. Now, what exactly is Putin's endgame, as far as how he perceives it, is not certain, as he keeps things very close to the chest. He drops little hints every once in a while. But what needs to be understood is that the West is not free from blame in poking the Russian bear to action. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the West, namely NATO and the European Union, has continued to spread eastward and put pressure on the borders of Russia itself. The continued desire of Ukraine to join the NATO nations was one of the most significant sticking points that helped instigate the Russian invasion or justify it in their minds. The liberalized West, and when we talk about liberal, we mean politically and, of course, morally, and the heavy-handed totalitarianism of Eastern Europe are not compatible and are now playing out a dangerous collision course. The West is under the spell of globalism. I'm sure you all have heard the phrase, the Great Reset. It is a very, very real thing that will affect us, and it is affecting us personally, individually, in our lives. The West is under the spell of globalism, or the Great Reset, and grotesquely obsessed with liberal social issues, climate change, equity, and of course the LGBTQ ... acceptance. They're obsessed with this. The West is growing their own brand of totalitarianism under the guise of democracy. Since the fall of the Soviet Empire, an atheistic regime, Russia, has reinvented itself as the great champion, or maybe we shouldn't say reinvent, but revived itself, as the great champion for traditional Orthodox Christian values. Doesn't mean they're good people. They're not. But they claim to have this, to be the defenders of Christian values. They have no sympathies for the hedonistic and social agenda-centered values of the West. Maybe except for the fact that it is a tool in destroying the West from within, and that's what we see happening, as the West is destroying itself from within. Now, in looking beyond Ukraine, the conflict in Ukraine is simply a stepping stone for Russia as it secures its power in the Black Sea region. But what we are seeing from this is a geopolitical domino effect that is facilitating the standing up of the image empire, the standing up of that image. The post-World War II order that puts the U.S. as the world's dominant economic and military power is changing, and very rapidly. Part of it is from the national suicide taking place in the U.S. and the West in general. And we'll talk more on that later. Western nations are trying to counter Russian aggression by weaponizing economic tools and sanctions. But instead of weakening Russia, we are seeing the opposite outcome, as Western nations are now facing economic collapse. Energy supplies that feed the economies of the West are now threatened, as well as indications of life-threatening, and I emphasize this, life-threatening food shortages and famine across the globe and even among rich and developing countries. Not just by the events of Ukraine, we know that the wheat, I was going to say more on this, and I will make a few comments about this, but the disruption to the supply of wheat, coming out of Ukraine has a major impact on the world supplies in general. And of course, at the same time, we're seeing famine in North Africa. I just read this morning that, Kansas wheat production is down 40% this year due to the intense heat drought that is taking place, and that doesn't even include Texas and Colorado in that as well. So we have a conflagration of a lot of different circumstances coming together that is going to put great strains on the food supply in the coming months and probably the next couple of years. Now, what this creates and what really drives nations is energy and food. Speaking of the energy side of things, we know that gas, petroleum, and coal, what we call carbon energies, drive the world. Yet the West is engaged in an act of delusion and geopolitical suicide. And of course, it's a delusion that is instigated by the Elohim, clearly. But it is mankind that carries out the folly of these things. The West is engaged in an act of delusion and geopolitical suicide. They have decided that without man's immediate intervention, the world is about to be irreversibly wrecked. So therefore, carbon energies, in their view, must be abandoned and abandoned immediately. Though the West attempts to move towards so-called green energies, wind and solar, the reality is that these are not workable solutions to operating the world we live in today. Everything in this modern world is connected to carbon sources. In the little chart that we put up here, the percentage we have, well over 30% is related to oil. Around 30% is natural gas. Coal constitutes, about 12 to 15%. Nuclear is just under 10%, but nuclear keeps shrinking because they keep closing down the nuclear plants. Biofuels, small part of that. Hydroelectric is even smaller. And then, of course, our other involves some of our so-called green energies. Now, while the Western world claims to be transitioning into a carbon-neutral future, we hear, of course, the World Economic Forum's 2030 plan is to stop all carbon use of carbon energies by 2030, 8 years from now. They are finding out quickly that there is no viable solution in existence to take its place. This is why we are seeing the self-induced crisis of energy shortages, runaway inflation, and impending famine and food shortages. As of 2015, the United States was the top producer of natural gas, and as of 2020, was completely energy independent. Russia was standing at second place in regard to natural gas production, with a growing hold over Europe as its primary supplier. I have a little map there that shows just by the dark yellow shows those who are pretty much at 100% levels of dependence upon Russian fuel, natural gas, oil. Germany, slightly to a lesser degree, Italy, Hungary, and Turkey, and then, of course, France, Spain, and the UK also have a part in partaking of Russian fuels, but not quite to the same extent. Now, with the United States fading due to government restrictions, Russia finds itself in the dominant energy role, and they're using this power as a weapon. And brethren have been talking about this for many years now, is that we would see the use of energy as a weapon. Most Eastern European countries are already entirely dependent on Russian natural gas. Now, it is an amazing act of folly, but no doubt driven by the Elohim, Western European nations and the U.S. have reduced their energy independence in a show, and that's really all it is a show, of pursuing green energy. While they have reduced their own reliance on independently acquired sources of energy, such as nuclear power in Europe, they have increased their dependence on Russian fuel. Where are their green energies? As a matter of fact, Russia's energy sales are booming. Despite the Ukrainian war and despite all the talk of sanctions. So Western nations pat themselves on the back for implementing green policies to their economies, while at the same time they turn to Russia to fill in the gap. We've even seen, supposedly Germany's supposed to, by the end of the year, pull back majorly, if not completely, from Russian fuel, but I just don't see that happening. And of course, we'll talk about where they are trying to turn to, and that's Israel. We'll talk more about that in a little bit as well, which is a huge development. The United States itself imports billions of dollars of Russian oil after only 2 years removed from energy independence. You can't make this stuff up. Now, just this past week, we see Israel and Egypt making a deal with Europe to supplement the amount of natural gas they need. Countries such as Germany and France are claiming that they wish to pull away from dependence on Russia and are looking south for that solution. Now again, we will have more to say on that in just a little bit, but this is a major development, and especially in the light of the prophetic word and what we're talking about here in Daniel 11. Now what we see as one of the most significant developments out of the Ukrainian conflict is the great shift in economic power taking place. Since the closing months of the Second World War, the United States has been positioned as the world's leading economic power. The dollar has been the standard currency of international trade, especially as it involved oil. Since the late 1970s, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia has negotiated an agreement to use U.S. dollars for oil contracts. And interestingly enough, Henry Kissinger was central in making this happen. This came to be known as the petrodollar, or petrodollar recycling. Oops. And just to back up for a moment, is that Russia has made nearly $100 billion from fuel exports in war's first 100 days. So that within the first 100 days of the Ukrainian war, they made $100 billion from fuel exports. And France increased its imports of Russian oil during the first 100 days of the war in Ukraine. So all the talk about terrible Russia, and then France is going to go ahead and just increase the amount that they're taking in. At the same time that they reduce their, and close down their own nuclear plants. And again, we'll talk about that more in just a little bit. But let's talk about the petrodollar. I find this really fascinating, and this is stuff that they didn't teach me in school. I don't know about you all, but they didn't teach me this stuff in school. What a nation does is they make an agreement to import oil from OPEC nations, but it has to be purchased in U.S. dollars. In the case of Saudi Arabia, they would recycle U.S. dollars back to American contractors. So America would buy their oil, but Saudi Arabia and then eventually other countries would have to hire out American contractors. So we got this business going in a circular thing. So we'll send over our people as long as you get our contractors for making buildings or building infrastructure. So it's just this circular thing that's involved, and it's all done in U.S. dollars. They would be involved in transferring technology and improving infrastructure with Saudi Arabia. Other nations have jumped on board with this and have benefited from the same recycling bandwagon. What's this have to do with anything? Well, it has a lot to do with what we see crumbling around us. Over the course of the last 45 years, this has given the U.S. enormous financial and political leverage over nations who wish to do business on the international stage. Over half of global currency reserves are and trade in U.S. dollars. Another big player is the euro. The euro dollar. This allows the U.S. to use its financial power as a tool of pressure or a weapon on other nations to bend to U.S. interests. To push back risks destabilizing the petrodollar, and therefore that nations or even the world economy, causing a worldwide financial crisis. This would cause a worldwide financial crisis. Russia is pushing back. And we see the destabilizing impact it is having. Russia has been on the receiving end of U.S. sanctions since it invaded Crimea in 2014. Now that Russia has invaded Ukraine, the U.S. and its allies have been using the power of the dollar to lock Russia out of the world economic system, which is known as weaponizing the dollar. At first, we saw Russia's ruble crash to pennies on the dollar. Everybody was game over. Russia's done. We got it. Since then, since the opening days of the Ukrainian war and the crash of the ruble, It has now rebounded some 50% since it invaded Ukraine and is the fastest rising currency in the world. Nobody cared about the Russian ruble until the Ukrainian war. The world needs Russian oil and natural gas, as well as agricultural commodities such as grain and fertilizers. Russia now requires the trade of these goods in the ruble. I said, okay, you're not going to let us play ball on the economic scene anymore. We'll create our own economy. And if you want what we have, you've got to do it in the ruble, which they have also chosen to back by gold. The U.S. financial system is based on nothing but good faith. It is not backed by gold. It is not backed by silver. It is what we call fiat money. Fake. The only thing that it has is the value of what people perceive it to have. The U.S. stopped allowing the dollar to be traded for gold in 1971 under President Richard Nixon, and there's, you know, outlying reasons for that as well. It was seemed like a good move at the time. We have to understand, and I know we have to close this up for this period, but we have to understand that Putin's actions are not knee-jerk in nature, as Russia has been slowly moving this direction before the Ukrainian invasion. Russia has been slowly stockpiling gold. And if we see more nations shift to a gold standard for currency, the U.S. dollar is finished. And so goes U.S. influence. Undermining the U.S. dollar and coercing nations away from dependence on it puts the debt-laden American economy at serious risk. Countries such as China, India, and several South American countries are joining with Russia to accept the new ruble standard. The Ukraine situation has only sped up the process. Much of what we see in the U.S. is in fact that it is simply falling in on its own debt-ridden weight and uncontrolled spending. The loss of its world currency standard, and this, the news people are talking about this, depending on what kind of news you watch, and you got to be very, very careful there. But the loss of its world currency standard has been on the horizon for several years. But the struggle over Ukraine is pushing it over the edge. Now, the end time implications of this. Daniel 11, verse 40. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. With all that is happening, and very rapidly, we are seeing a struggle take place that is more characterized by east and west. Not north and south, but east and west. We have put a lot of emphasis throughout these classes on the role of Daniel 11. Daniel 11 speaks to a tremendous political and military rivalry between the king of the north and the king of the south. Ezekiel, again, 38, speaks more specifically of this rivalry as between the Gogian Confederacy of Nations versus the Tarshish Alliance of Nations. The Gogian Confederacy will include, and this leads into tomorrow, the Gogian Confederacy will include Russia, Germany, France, Iran, Syria, and portions of North Africa, Libya, and Ethiopia. The Tarshish Alliance will be made up of Britain and its young lions, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, for certain, and possibly India. By all present appearances, the U.S. still has a role in this Tarshish Alliance, along with the various oil-producing nations of the Arabian Peninsula. But we will, as far as the U.S. is concerned, we will see. The U.S. is in big trouble. But the end time stage is not entirely set. The king of the north, Russia, has a strong foothold in the territories of the former Seleucid kingdom, especially in Syria. It is expected that dominance over Turkey and the Bosphorus or Dardanelles will complete Russia's designation as the king of the north. But what about the king of the south? We are to look to the Egyptian territory to answer that. So is Egypt the king of the south? No. Britain once had a powerful presence in Egypt from the 19th to the 20th century. We would expect a heightened presence of the Tarshish Alliance in this area. We kind of see it, but not fully yet. To keep the flow of natural gas moving, which Egypt is becoming very prominent at, natural gas along with Israel, to keep the flow of natural gas moving may be one reason, as well as protection of the Suez Canal. The U.S. maintains a robust naval presence in the Eastern Mediterranean and an assortment of military bases through the Arabian Peninsula. Prophecy points for us to expect as vital of this north-south rivalry, with Israel caught in the middle. And we'll stop at that point, and I apologize for stealing some minutes there.